Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, how the Athens anti-discrimination movement is training the next generation of activists.
Before I moved to Athens, I was not involved in politics or activism. So Athens as a community birthed me as an activist, made me get involved in politics, because as an activist, I started to understand how local government operated.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, a UGA researcher hits a milestone in his work to develop a new coronavirus vaccine.
We are hoping on July 26th, we will have a first patient in for the testing in the U.S.
And our panel on the week in news and politics.
Those stories, plus counting ACC's trees, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. The Athens anti-discrimination movement was launched in 2016 to address alleged racial discrimination by downtown businesses, and has since branched into other services involving bail and legal support, youth programs, and education. Now, the nonprofit is launching the Justice for Black Lives Academy to recruit and train people of color for office and activist roles. Mocha Jasmine Johnson, president and co-founder of the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement, spoke with my colleague Chris Shoup earlier this week.
What can you tell us about the Justice for Black Lives Academy? Tell us about this.
Well, the Justice for Black Lives Academy is basically a 501c4 organization that I decided to launch shortly after running for office in 2020. It's a way to recruit, develop, and encourage other people of color to run for office, to get more politically involved, not just on a state level, but also just involved in politics, period, because whomever is in office makes decisions for our community, for our district, for our state, you know, on so many different levels. And I believe this is time for change. It's time for new leadership. And we need to encourage people to get involved in politics because it impacts their lives. So the Justice for Black Lives Academy is a way to teach people how to fish for themselves. Mm. I want to encourage people to not only see yourself as an individual that can run for office, but also learn how to organize in the community, keep people updated with important issues and policies that impact marginalized communities and people of color. And so that's what Justice for Black Lives Academy is. It's a leadership academy. It's to recruit, develop, and encourage other people to run for office, become community organizers and leaders, and to get involved.
So when you talk about this academy, is this a grassroots local thing that you're doing, or how big are you looking at with this?
I'm starting with the state of Georgia. Of course, Athens is my home. This is where we're going to start, you know, the first launch, this first push, the first recruitment, because before I moved to Athens, I was not involved in politics or activism. So Athens as a community birthed me as an activist, made me get involved in politics, because as an activist, I started to understand how local government operated. And I want to take it throughout the state of Georgia. I want to have a few seminars and conferences throughout the state of Georgia, especially in areas where it's concentrated, where there's a lot of just people that are not as engaged or checked out of politics, but we need them to be involved. So I want to target those areas and offer this seminar and have different conferences and recruit people to get more involved and to teach them, you know, give them the tools they need to advocate for themselves.
Well, you mentioned the organization aspect of this. What events do you have planned, and what sort of speakers and other leaders have you got confirmed?
We had an information session. Madeline Jones and Devin Pandy joined us. We had the mayor of Hull County, Mariah Parker, Paul Gaze. They all joined us on this first information session, just sharing their experience to encourage other people. Now my goal is to recruit 100 people. My goal is to continue to push this and try to recruit 100 people. And once we have our 100 people, then we're going to launch our first seminar. It's going to be here in Athens. I'm hoping that this will happen in September sometime, but the goal between now and, you know, the next 30 days is to recruit as many people as I can to send the word out there, you know. So if you know somebody that you think would be a good leader in the political realm, you like tell them about Justice for Black Lives Academy. So my goal is to recruit 100 people and then launch the first event here in Athens.
Tell our listeners, if there's someone out there who wants to get involved with Justice for Black Lives Academy, or perhaps there's a listener out there that wants to help, how can they get involved in this?
We're looking for experienced candidates and elected officials that want to share the knowledge and experience that they had. It doesn't matter. It can be people of color or non. If you want to fight back against oppression, this academy is for you. Check us out at justiceforblacklivesacademy.org.
Thanks for taking some time out to speak with us today and to talk to our listeners on Athens News Matters.
Mocha Jasmine Johnson is president and co-founder of the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement. In a video released by the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement's YouTube page, Clark County Auditor Stephanie Maddox said her new contract includes a work improvement plan that she equates to disciplinary action. This is the latest installment in an ongoing saga we've discussed here on Athens News Matters before. In June, Maddox accused Mayor Kelly Gertz and City Manager Blaine Williams of intimidating and discriminatory conduct. The commission voted last month 9-1 to renew her contract, and that was renewed for another 2 years. So here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Blake Odd from Flagpole, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd. So what do you make of her complaint regarding her contract? Is there a sense that it's warranted after complaints about her work performance, or are her claims substantiated that it's retaliation for filing a complaint?
This is a very uncomfortable story to discuss, but I have to say that I don't think it's warranted to say that it's retaliation, because currently the audit committee isn't meeting anymore because they meet to review Auditor Maddox's work, and there isn't anything to review right now. And so they've stopped meeting for months. So I don't think it's right to say that this is retaliation.
Yeah, I agree with Chris. I mean, she was put on, I guess, what's called a work improvement plan. And, you know, as I've said before, her audits are terrific, but she doesn't do very many of them. And I think that's the issue is we've only seen 3 audits in over 5 years that she's been the auditor. And she has 2 vacant positions in her office that have been vacant for a year and hasn't filled them, and nothing is getting done. That's kind of a problem.
Yeah, and there are 2 audits that were almost complete like over a year ago, and just for some reason those haven't been, you know, submitted to the mayor and commission yet. And I mean, I guess they're not complete yet, and that's just very strange to me. I don't know what's going on here. She did have 2 staff members who I believe they quit about the time when, you know, everything stopped getting done. But, you know, if you're in charge of an office like that, you have to, you know, try to fill those positions. There have been independent contractors that she's been working with, but still, you know, nothing is getting done. And I don't know why. And I think it's a strange and sad story.
she did another video, and I don't really understand why we keep seeing these videos from the anti-discrimination movement, and that seems to be the method that she's using to communicate to the public, but that seems very unusual to me for a government employee, I guess. But she did another one where she's asking the public for ideas of things to audit, and I guess that's fine, but it's sort of contributing to this false narrative, this false idea that, you know, the auditor is sort of an independent investigator or an ombudsman, you know, type of person, and the auditor is not. The auditor doesn't decide what she's going to look into or what department she's going to audit. The audit committee does that. She works for the mayor and commission, and they direct, you know, what the auditor does and what the auditor looks into. And then, you know, there, like you mentioned, there are these two audits that are unfinished. You know, why is she sort of casting about for new things to do when, you know, there are two audits that, you know, people have been waiting on for a year that aren't completed?
I think that Chris hit it on the head when he said that we don't really understand this position and how, why it's not produced more. We can look back tenure of John Wolf, and it pretty much ended up being one a year, but it was often very hard even to produce that, and he had two staff members. I don't know if those positions haven't been advertised. I don't know what the deal is, but one person alone is not going to be able to produce what the commission seems to demand.
We'll take a break right here, but we'll be right back with more state and local news after the break. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. We're back with Blake Odd from Flagpole, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd, talking about state and local news. First up this segment, a lot happening since we last met. One of the big developments is that Athens is in the path of a high-speed rail line. I know, Gwen, this was particularly exciting for you.
It really was. When you've looked at this thing since the 90s, I went to Washington only twice during the time I was my two terms as mayor, and one of them was designed to try to get rail on that 316. If this is a wonderful thing, I know it's far off, but we're talking about a train that will go almost over 100 miles an hour if it goes on the potential route. And, you know, that is a fast trip to Atlanta.
Yeah, you know, this is all cool. This is a great idea. I wish it would happen. It's not going to happen. If it does happen, we'll all be dead. The date on this project, I think, is 2050. And I would just be surprised if it just ever occurs. So
I understand why Blake's saying that. It shows a lot of sophistication and shows his age. But you've got to look at right now, we have trillions devoted to infrastructure in America. And there's going to be a great need for having plans and projects that are ready to be implemented. And I believe that that Infrastructure Act will move this up a number of years. I think this is going to be a product of our new Infrastructure Act.
That might be, but if you look at the
There was money for high-speed rail in the Obama stimulus, and that was in 2009, and none of those projects are, you know, some of them haven't even started yet, let alone anything being completed, and that was 12 years ago.
Well, even if it takes until 2050, I plan on being alive in 2050, so I will be glad to see it when it happens.
That's the right attitude, Chris. We'll be here. You know, I get it. It's like, it's been sort of a dream to have high-speed rail, just passenger rail in the Southeast.
And we need it. We need it so badly, and we needed it 30 years ago. And I just, like, I'm a huge fan of this idea. I just, you know, we should have been, talking about this 30 years ago, and it should be, you know, it shouldn't be happening 30 years from now. It should be happening now because we started talking about it 30 years ago.
So let's talk about, train line not being used anymore. There was some movement with the Murmur Trestle.
Movement, literally.
Yes.
Yes. They're taking it down. It was proven to not be safe to leave it up, which nobody is surprised. That's why we're not building things with wooden rails anymore. But I think we have a beautiful plan, the new one. It replicates and honors the trestle in a great way. And it introduces the Firefly Trail into Athens, which I think is going to be a great asset. So I'm sorry to see it come down. I'm glad we're honoring it, and I'm excited about what will replace it.
Yeah, a lot of people are upset about this, but, you know, as Gwen mentioned, you know, the bridge is not structurally sound, and if it were to be used, almost all of the wood in it would have to be replaced. So, you know, is it even the same trestle, I guess? And this decision was made a couple of years ago. There was a lot of input on it. The commission decided that they were going to sort of replicate part of the bridge and then have a couple of steel arches on either side of it. I'm sure a lot of people didn't realize this was going on until they actually started dismantling it. But the fact that they're building a new bridge now means that it's going to be so much easier to use Firefly Trail. You're not going to have to go all the way down into Dudley Park and come back up again. It's going to be a level path all the way. So it's just going to be much easier to use. And that's terrific.
Yeah, we really needed this bridge. And I think part of the beauty of the trestle was that it was sort of from another era, and it was, you know, never made to last. And it was kind of falling apart even in the 80s, sort of when, you know, the Murmur album came out, it was still kind of like ghostly and in a process of decay, I think. And so it was never going to last. We just have to appreciate it while our memories now, and then in honoring it with a new trestle design.
Let me just say this, that REM has consistently been so impressed with how much Athens honored that trestle and sees them as continuing to honor the trestle. So that problem is not there for them.
Yeah, I mean, every time I've ever talked to anyone from REM about this, their attitude has basically been like, we don't care what they do. So they really have no opinion.
Well, let's move on about development leaving Athens. Obviously, the Varsity, I know people are talking about this. So the Athens location is gone, and it's sprouting up in two locations, but not in Athens.
Well, it's kind of funny. The Varsity says they're in Athens. One of them is in Oconee County, off the connector, and the other all the way out on 316 in Bethlehem in Barrow County. According to their marketing materials, those are both in Athens. So
the question remains whether or not this new development that is very unattractive and it's greedy the way it uses up that square, it's going to make a huge difference in the way we feel about that corner. And lots of people are wondering if the promise that there may be a Varsity there has any merit to it.
Well, if you're referring to the development that's going up at Milligan Broad, no, I don't think there is going to be a Varsity at that location, as far as I know. We haven't really seen a lot of detail about this. You know, it's just all very, you know, kind of in the sketchbook stage. it looks pretty generic. Fuqua, the Atlanta company that's building this, does not have a very good reputation. They've done a lot of really horrendous auto-centric kind of developments in urban Atlanta that don't belong. That's sort of what they do. But the commission put an overlay district here 2 years ago. And so everyone has known since they did that exactly what is going to go here and exactly what the commission wrote in the overlay zoning is exactly what is being proposed. So we're getting what we were always going to get, no matter who did it.
I'll say the same thing I've said all along. That overlay should have required a return with a planned development. There is no area of our community where we've had this large a development in the middle of our populated areas without a very carefully planned development. And so I continue to wish that we had had that.
But this isn't the final design, right? This is just like the beginning stages of it. Is that correct?
We have no control except that they meet those few things that were in the overlay.
Right. Yeah. And it is a very preliminary design. I mean, it's just a, you know, it's a yellow box on a piece of paper at this point. There's no architectural drawings. There's no blueprints. There's nothing like that yet. If you read the overlay zoning that they passed, then that's what it's going to be because that's what they're allowed to do.
Right. And Fuqua, as Blake said, is not known for its design ability, for its pedestrian sensitivity, for even the mixed has had trouble in them because of the quality of their development. So we are getting what we are going to get. Let's see what, maybe in 50 years, by the time the train comes, a new company will come.
Well, you know, and I don't want to sound like I'm against this because, I mean, that corner is such prime real estate. And I've always said that, you know, I think to have 3 acres of parking there is such a waste. And I'm happy to see something other than a giant parking lot go up.
I do wish we could keep a couple of those magnolia trees, though. They're beautiful. And, I mean, they can do whatever they want with the back of it in the parking lot, but...
Yeah, that would be nice, and it would have been nice if they had written that into if the commissioner made it a requirement, but they didn't. So I'm sure that those magnolias are probably goners because that's property that you can develop and build something on, and I'm sure they'll chop them down.
We'll stop here today, guys. That's all the time we have for the panel. You just heard from Blake Aud of Flagpole, Gwen O'Looney of WXAG, and Chris Dowd of Athens Politics Nerd. Coming up after the break, a UGA researcher hits a major milestone in the development of a new coronavirus vaccine. And we'll take a trip to the UGA Wild Peanut Lab. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
You know that feeling where you're exhausted by the news, but you also can't stay away from the news? I am here to help with that. My name is Sam Sanders. My show is called It's Been a Minute. Every week, journalists and I process the week of news and culture in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming. Listen to It's Been a Minute every week from NPR.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Back in December of last year, we talked to Dr. Biao He, who is a professor of infectious diseases at UGA's Vet School. We talked about his research into a COVID-19 vaccine that's a one-dose nasal spray.
Recently, his team moved closer to success with test results in mice. Dr. He is here to talk more about the progress he's made since we last spoke. Welcome, Dr. He.
Alexia, glad to be back. It's always great to talk with you.
And it's always great having you on the show. So let's start off with you explaining the process of creating this COVID-19 vaccine.
Yeah, so we did some genetic engineering to create a very common kennel cough vaccine to use to make a COVID vaccine. So the vaccine, the backbone of the vaccine has been in use for many, many years. So the reason I point this out is as a developer for a vaccine, the safety is the foremost on my mind. So when we develop vaccine, we first want to make sure the vaccine is safe. So in this case, we have a high confidence the vaccine is derived from a vaccine to be used for many years and without any safety concern. So we know the vaccine hopefully will be very safe in human.
And can you tell us how your vaccine differs from those currently in use, like Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson?
So our vaccine is very different that it is a nasal spray. So basically, you don't need to get an injection. You basically go to the site, essentially get a spray in your nose, and that's it. So there's only one dose, and if you're afraid of needle, then this will be a very, very good alternative.
Have you run into any particular challenges with developing the vaccine since we last spoke?
Well, as you know, I was very optimistic to get the vaccine into human in March or April, and we did manage to produce the vaccine and get testing for the vaccine done. But unfortunately, because of the pandemic and the situation changed with the vaccination program at the time, so our clinical trial got postponed. And I'm glad to tell you, and right now we got cleared by FDA for clinical trial, and we are hoping on July 26th, we will have a first patient in for the testing in the US.
Great, so you're gonna have your first patient in for testing on July 26th. What results are you hoping for?
Well, there are three parameters we set up to test for the phase one trial in this case. One, of course, as I mentioned before, safety, safety, safety. So number one, we want to make sure when we do this spray in volunteers that there is no safety concern. That means there is no severe reaction to the vaccine. And then number two, we want to make sure there is not too severe a reaction to the vaccine. If there's anything uncomfortable for people who get this nasal spray, we want to find out. So that's the second parameter we're looking. The third one, we want to see whether there is immune response generated by our vaccine. So that's, of course, will be tested more extensively in phase two and phase three trial to see efficacy of the vaccine.
And were you able to do any research into protection from COVID-19 variants, especially since the Delta variant is spreading?
So we have done work using the vaccine we have developed against variant. We haven't got to the Delta yet. We're testing Beta, and it looks very good. The vaccine we have has very good protection against Beta variant. And of course, we're moving along to test its efficacy against the Delta.
Right. So right now, I just want to make sure I understand this clearly. The vaccines we have now, very effective in preventing us from getting sick, which is great.
That's right.
That's everybody wants that. So they're great in preventing us from getting sick. Yours, a second generation vaccine, will prevent transmission, which is something the current vaccines don't necessarily do, correct?
Right. So the current vaccine, I have confidence that they may reduce. But again, you know, when you have a vaccine right now, that the key is make sure we don't die from this disease unnecessarily. And then we, of course, always want to improve on what we can do now. But also, and I think it's one of those situations that we look for something as alternative as well. Like I pointed out early, many people don't like needles. And also, like Pfizer, Moderna vaccine are two doses. Now, can we do this with a single dose, right? And also, they are requiring somewhat sophisticated cold chain to deliver to the vaccine to the sites. So our vaccine also, we do not need a needle, and we are confident with the vaccine will be delivered in a regular 4-degree refrigerator. So we don't need a minus 20 or minus 80 cold chain. So there are many things we can do to improve on what we have right now.
Yeah, that is that's something to look forward to. That it's getting easier, but right now, of course, you do recommend get the vaccine now that you do have.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that the current vaccine is very effective, and get it now. Don't wait.
Right. And Dr. He, what does the timeline look like if everything goes smoothly with your vaccine?
Right. So we have a first patient in, if everything goes well, on July 26th. And give a shout out to Dr. Fauci at University of Rochester in New York. So if you're around that area, you know, volunteer if you haven't got the vaccine yet. And we hope to finish this trial, phase one trial, within the next few months. And from phase one, of course, we're going to move to phase two, hopefully before the end of the year. And again, that's just expanded testing of the vaccine, mostly a look at the safety, but also started to look at the efficacy in terms of immune response, how well it protects people, right? And then we go on to do the phase three trial, which I hope is sometime next year, early part of next year. And, you know, it will be ready once the phase three trial is over. It can be, you know, done as quickly as 6 months or 12 months or however long it takes for the phase three trial. And it depends on how the situation goes with the pandemic.
And one big public health issue is vaccine hesitancy. It seems as though vaccine rates are plateauing, while some states like Georgia still have very low rates. What should public health officials and others be doing to get more people vaccinated in general?
Well, this is really a tough question. As a scientist, I always feel like we want to develop as the best vaccine as possible. That's why people say afraid of a needle. Let's do a vaccine without a needle. And if you don't like two doses, let's do a single dose. But, you know, current vaccine is very effective. And I just, all I can say is please get it. As a, you know, the truth is, as a scientist, right, we want to develop new things, but ultimately we want to do something that's useful, right? We want to do something that's useful and productive for the society. And right now, the best thing to do for society is for everyone to get a vaccine. I know some people young and healthy or just healthy and fearlessness and all great, but it's really not just about you. It's about the society, about other people.
Right. The benefits greatly outweigh the risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, we can always do better with whatever we're developing. But at this point, I know, I feel like instead of promoting our vaccine, we're really promoting a vaccine that is being, you know, in use right now. And society will be better off if we all get vaccinated.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time today, Dr. He.
Well, thank you, Alexia. And again, it's always great talking with you.
When was the last time you had a really delicious peanut? Well, you might have University of Georgia researchers to thank for that great experience, as scientists in the university's Wild Peanut Lab have been looking to the past to grow the peanuts of the future. WUGA's Jessica Wurst has this report.
It's a sunny Saturday afternoon, and you're at a Braves game. Or Dudley Park. Or maybe even a concert. But no matter where you are, no summer experience is complete without this. That's right. The sweet sound of cracking open a flavorful peanut.
the peanut that is produced in the United States is of the highest quality.
Meet Soraya Bertioli, a senior research scientist at the University of Georgia. She runs the Wild Peanut Lab with her husband, David Bertioli.
The American farmers and the processing industry produces a quality of such amazing standard and an amazing price as well. And when you look at such a high quality product as peanut in terms of nutrition, in terms of quality and healthiness, we live at an amazing time in history.
Even if this is a golden age for peanuts, the Bertiolis say there's still room for improvement. Their mission is twofold: investigate the genome structure of the peanut and create a better peanut product overall. Here's David Bertioli.
We take wild peanuts and we cross them with cultivated peanuts. And then using genetics and going through generations, we get out a peanut that is like a normal field peanut, produces well, but it'll have an extra characteristic from the wild. Most commonly improved disease resistance, like resistance against nematodes, which are little worms that parasitize the roots, or resistance against fungi, which attack the leaves.
The genetics are complex, so let's take a minute to break down their research. As you heard, the name of the game is cross-selection, which is a breeding method. Wild peanut species from Brazil are used because of their adaptability.
They contain lots of genes, lots of alleles that helped them throughout the millennia adapt to the different stresses, to the different environments, because you see them by the riverbanks, in dry areas, in flooded areas, in areas after burn. So they adapt to such a diverse range of environments that we're certain to find genes that will help us make the peanut here more adaptable, more resilient.
Of course, this doesn't happen overnight.
They have to go through a long process of crosses, selection, and it may take between the first cross and the cultivar release, it may take 10 years, which is actually quite fast for breeding, for a breeding time, but it's, you know, it takes a long time.
But the wait is worth it because the final product increases profitability and sustainability.
You don't have to, for instance, spray so much. You don't have to run the tractor around the field, which is burning up diesel. That all saves money, so that improves the farmer's profitability. So producing better peanuts is really a win all round for everybody, the environment, the farmer, and the consumer.
And at the Wild Peanut Lab, you can get a look at the peanut of the future.
These are the tetraploidized plants, and you see they have bigger leaves, and these have smaller leaves, and this is the greenhouse, or we call it the Feed the Future nursery, because here's where the peanuts for the future are being produced as we speak.
And even with the significant work they've already done, there's always something new to investigate.
There are lots of diseases. There's white mold, there's aflatoxin, there's all sorts of, it's a whole host of things that can cause trouble for farmers. So there's plenty of work to do.
The diseases we mentioned before, they mutate. So there's always an arms race between the disease and the plant. So we're always on top of the diseases that mutate.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Jessica Wurst.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. You know the feeling of sitting in the shade of a tree on a hot summer day? Well, this is just one of the many benefits of trees to a community like Athens. And according to the Athens-Clarke County Sustainability Office, Athens has more tree canopy than any other U.S. community with over 100,000 residents. Can you believe that? This summer, the ACC Forestry Program, in partnership with the University of Georgia and the Georgia Forestry Commission, is conducting a community tree study. Rodney Walters, the community forester, is here to talk about the study. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit about this community tree study and what you hope to learn from it?
This is a statistical quantification of trees in Athens-Clarke County, involving both public and private trees. And it really is connected to the iTree tools or suite developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which helps to estimate the ecosystem services and structural characteristics of community trees. So trees do provide a wide range of benefits for people. These benefits include reduction of stormwater runoff, health and psychosocial benefits, crime reduction, community cohesion, and other ecosystem services. The iTree Echo calculator, essentially it's a type of calculator. It basically takes tree measurements and gives us information about the forest density, size of the trees, the age, species, composition, that sort of thing. And we get information about the forest structure.
So I'm assuming that then that information leads you to specific decisions. Talk a little bit about what some of those decisions might be. I mean, as far as you get the results and then what?
Yes. So this study has been developed to focus on specific land use categories. So for example, single family residential is one of those categories, public parks, public right-of-ways, et cetera. And by breaking it down into these categories, we can get information about things that are going on more specifically within the county. And it's really set up to be able to take a look at it from a management perspective, particularly for county-owned trees, but it can also inform other activities that involve the private sector through the planning department. And it really just gives us a better picture of what's going on within these different land use categories.
Well, I'm sure many of our listeners might already know the answer, but for those that might not, can you go ahead and give us the rundown of why so many of the trees in downtown that so many people just really loved, why they had to be culled?
There's a few things about trees that exist in highly urban conditions. The average lifespan of a downtown tree is 12 years. The trees down there have done much better than that. But basically, urban environments are extremely taxing on a tree system. So these living organisms really don't get what they need. Clayton Street is being redone. And, you know, underneath the sidewalks, there's all these different types of infrastructure, right? So there's there's water pipes and electrical and phone lines and sewer lines, and there's all this stuff. And so in order to be able to revamp some of that infrastructure, the trees did need to be removed.
Well, I'm assuming that a lot of the impetus for this study involves education and informing the community, just like you just did. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of conversations you hope this study will bring about?
Yeah, so well, first of all, you know, I think it'd be really helpful just to know kind of what we have as a county unit. You know, how many trees are out there? What kind of trees do we have? How old are they? Once we start getting better information that answers those questions, we can have an opportunity to start projecting into the future, to start doing a little bit of forecasting. We can come up with estimations about how the composition of the community forest may change over time. And then that can allow us to make decisions that will help us to adjust to those changing factors.
I mean, it truly is like a population study. I mean, you know, you know the population of your community, or you try to know as much about it as you can, and then you make decisions based on, like you said, the age of the population, the condition, where they are, how many there are. So it's much like just studying your own community, correct?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I have noticed in coming into the Athens community is that a lot of the trees out there are what we call pioneer species. These are short-lived trees. And a lot of the big trees, a lot of the water oak, the pine trees, they don't live very long. They live about 80 years. And so I'm really interested in understanding what percentage of our trees are actually pioneer species. And in a way to help inform how we may facilitate a transition into planting more long-lived trees, which will provide a wider range of benefits over a longer period of time.
And what are some of the more longer living trees? And when you say longer living, what sort of time frame are we talking about?
Well, some of them, like the southern red oak, can live up to 300 years.
Wow.
White oak, and under perfect conditions, can live up to 600 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Many of the oaks can live, you know, 150, 200 years pretty easily. Some of the elms around here can live 150 years or more. And really, the very large trees are the trees that provide the most benefits. So if we can help to cultivate these longer-lived species, get them big, you know, and then keep them around longer, we'll have more benefits for the community.
So what do people need to look for as far as just the overall health of maybe their own trees?
So trees as living organisms, they really have basic requirements. So space is the biggest factor. Well, it's the second biggest factor. The good quality soils is essential for a good, healthy tree, and also have enough space in which to grow. And that includes both below ground space and above ground space. So when you plant a tree, you really need to think about the mature size of that tree and what function it's going to play in the landscape as a mature organism. Trees require long-term planning and long-term management, and they help us to think more long-term and really in more sustainable ways. And when we start considering the needs of trees, it helps us to take a longer-term perspective and kind of see the bigger picture in a different way.
Rodney Walters is the Athens-Clarke County Community Forester. Thanks so much for joining us on Athens News Matters today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Jessica Wurst, Lucas Trevor, Devons Wald, and Sarah Train. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. And before we go, we want to commend our production team. Athens News Matters picked up two awards at last month's Public Media Journalists Association Awards, including one for Best Writing.
We'd love for you to listen back to today's stories and all of our past work, and you can do that over at WUGA.org. For Chris Shoup, I'm Alexia Ridley. Thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News.